This is Kathy coming to you with the Bloomington Normal Pantograph for Monday, May 18th. Starting on page one, which is the front page, Miller Park Zoo in Bloomington. Zoo breeds, saves endangered species. And they have a picture of a very large anteater, a South American anteater. And it says that the zoo goers learned about the giant anteater Saturday during Endangered Species Day at the Miller Park Zoo, which houses several dozen different endangered species. As an accredited member of the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, Miller Park Zoo participates in the Species Survival Program, aiming to conserve endangered species. What we do here is help to breed them and keep the species going, said the zoo's events and volunteer coordinator Sylvia Hsu. We've had some successful releases into the wild with the Red Wolves program. In fact, the majority of the animals cared for in the zoo are classified in one way or another as endangered, she said. Not all of them, but most of them, Hsu said Saturday. I'd probably say 75%. Yeah, it's pretty high. On Saturday, zoo goers help celebrate and learn about these animals like the red wolf, giant anteater, cotton-top tamarin, and the radiated tortoise at the Endangered Species Day, where the scavenger hunt, zookeeper talks, and chalk art drawings. Caring for so many endangered species is what makes the zoo, I think, a really special zoo, because it's not just about, you know, coming out to check out animals and look at them. But, you know, the keepers are very dedicated here about helping preserve these animals and taking good care of them, Hsu said. Artists who created the chalk art were actually entered into a contest with the Endangered Species Coalition, Hsu said, a national contest now in its sixth year that aims to raise awareness about at-risk animals and the Endangered Species Act. In fact, Miller Park Zoo has hosted a handful of artists who have been nationally recognized, Hsu said. Normal resident Trisha Morris chose to sketch an Arabian leopard because there are so few of them remaining in their natural environment, she said. It's probably like only 120 to 160 just left in the wild at all, just because their habitats are being ruined, Morris said. And they also have started to prey on livestock and things like that, so you have farmers hunting them. Creating art for the chalk contest inspires younger people to learn more about the animals in general, but endangered animals specifically, she said. It's kind of like a call of action to kind of get them involved, paying attention outside and into the real world, you know, seeing things that are beyond home life, said Morris, a mother herself. Kid-friendly events at Miller Park Zoo offer families an escape from technology and screen time, said Streeter mom Haley Robles. I think with AI and stuff right now, it's a good idea that kids are actually getting out there. I mean, my daughter loves being outside, but it's just not a very common thing. Everybody's faces are in their tablets, said Robles, who brought her daughter Amelia to visit their Bloomington friends, Allie Mathis and daughter Lucy. Maybe it'll inspire them to want to make a difference or to be outside, Mathis said. Miller Park Zoo, in caring for these animals the best they can, strives to educate and inspire, Hsu said, to be more than just a spectacle. Let's be honest about zoos. That's most of it. People come out here and it's for entertainment, she said. But there's also, we want to let them know there's more behind that, you know. What we're doing here is trying to conserve the species for the next 100 years or so. But Endangered Species Day is just one of the many ways that folks in Central Illinois can help Miller Park Zoo in its mission to conserve these species, Hsu said. One way is through adoption. I'll bet a symbolic one, she said. I mean, you can't actually get to take a flamingo home, but you get to support them. The other way is through volunteering in a variety of capacities, Hsu said, like helping to prepare animal diets, cleaning enclosures, and most importantly, enrichment. Enrichment is very important in order to be able to keep the animal feeling healthy and their brain stimulated and so forth, she said, because if they start to get bored, they can get stress, and stress is very bad for them. Stress could kill them. They're meant to be in the wild. Let's face it, it's true they're meant to be in the wild, but they're not. I look at them as like their ambassadors for their wild counterparts, Hsu said. They're here to teach the world. Hey, take care of the lemurs. They're important, you know. Their habitats are being destroyed. And also on the front page from the Normal Council, data center moratorium underpass on the agenda. Uptown station project cost goes up to $42.8 million by Matusik Janik. The Normal Town Council on Monday is set to consider four items tied to the long-delayed Uptown Underpass project, including a revised construction contract with PJ Hoare, Incorporated for nearly $33.9 million. The council will also consider a proposed moratorium on a new data center facilities while the town studies potential regulations for the emerging land use. The underpass-related items include votes on bond authority, a state funding agreement, a utility relocation agreement, and the main construction contract for the underpass at Uptown Station project. According to the council packet, the project's construction cost increased from $32,064,300 to $33,867,447, a difference of $1,803,147 from the cost approved by the council November 3rd. Town staff said the increase reflects changes needed to accommodate Union Pacific Railroad's temporary shoring requirements. The full project cost is now listed at $42,800,920. The updated funding plan includes $16,157,375 in federal build funds, $3 million in other federal funds, $6.25 million in state funds, $2.5 million through the Illinois Department of Transportation's Local Project Funding Program, and $14,893,545 from the town. According to the council packet, additional IDOT funding means that Normal's local share remains at $14,893,545 despite the increased construction cost. The council previously awarded the underpass contract to Millstone Weber LLC on November 3rd, but Millstone Weber later raised concerns about its ability to meet the project requirements and the timeline and then withdrew its bid on January 26th. The town then turned to PJ Hoare, the second bidder, and asked the company to review its bid and provide an updated proposal. According to the packet, the updated proposal was reviewed with multiple stakeholders, including PJ Hoare, Union Pacific Railroad, the Illinois Commerce Commission, the Federal Railroad Administration, WSP, and Ratio Architects. Union Pacific reviewed and approved modifications to the temporary shoring design, while the FRA provided guidance allowing the town to spend build grant funding up front to meet the September 30, 2027 grant deadline while extending the overall project completion timeline. If approved, work is expected to begin in June or July, with final completion scheduled for June 1, 2028. Federal build grant funds are expected to be spent by the required September 30, 2027 deadline. The council's underpass votes come after months of uncertainty following Millstone Weber's withdrawal and after renewed debate among council members over the project's cost, schedule, federal funding, and local tax increases approved to help pay for the town's share. The council approved increases to the food and beverage tax and hotel motel tax last fall to help finance the project. The Texas taxes took effect April 1st, though the town has not yet issued debt for the project. In new business, the council will consider an ordinance establishing a temporary moratorium on data center facilities in Normal. According to the council packet, town staff said the growth of data centers is a recent phenomenon, fueled by advances in artificial intelligence. Staff wrote that the data centers present distinct challenges and impacts, and that Normal's current land use regulations do not fully account for those factors. The proposed moratorium would pause the receipt, processing, approval, and issuance of any applications, permits, or approvals for data centers in the town. If approved, the moratorium would remain in effect through November 30th. If you want more information, you can call Matusik Janik at 309-820-3234. And from the agriculture side, by John T. Bennett. Fertilizer costs press Trump loyal farmers. Fertilizer costs have increased during the U.S.-Israeli war with Iran, putting pressure on American farmers who have been politically loyal to Donald Trump, as Democrats draw a direct connection between the president's actions and suffering farms. In his successful 2024 White House bid, 77.7% of the country's farm-dependent counties went to Trump, according to one analysis, based on the Department of Agriculture data and election results. Already hit hard by Trump's tariff and trade war with the rest of the world, the farmers are now facing increased cost of materials that make their crops grow. Faith Parham, an American Farm Bureau Federation economist, in a summary of a survey of more than 5,700 American farmers conducted in April, wrote that rising input costs tied to the conflict in the Middle East are adding strain to an already challenging farm economy. Fertilizer affordability challenges are the most acute in the South and Northeast, but remain a concern for farmers all across the region, Parham wrote. Around 70% of respondents report being unable to afford all the fertilizer they need. Farm diesel prices have increased 46% since the end of February, raising costs for field work, fertilizer transport, and irrigation during both planting and growing seasons. And more than half the respondents reported worsening finances reflecting rising fertilizer and fuel costs during spring planting and underscoring the urgent need for immediate economic assistance to keep farms' gates open, Parham wrote. The Trump administration and Republican lawmakers have taken steps to react, including a Senate Committee on Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry hearing set for the week. Chairman John Boozman, Republican of Arkansas, said the hearing would explore legislative solutions aimed at improving long-term stability and affordability for producers. He joined Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins at an April 28th event to highlight the administration's efforts to lower fertilizer costs. Farmers across Arkansas have told me that the cost and availability of fertilizer have always been a concern, but as they head into planting this year, it's even more worrying, Boozman said at that event. For her part, Rollins said the administration was laser-focused on the matter and had taken steps that included efforts to increase domestic phosphate production by over 200%. The administration also had led a push to up potash production by over 100%, she added. The administration has also suspended the Jones Act by stripping restrictions on fertilizer imports from Venezuela and revised diesel exhaust fluid rules, Rollins said. Other moves she mentioned, using a Commerce Department investment program, speeding permitting, expediting fertilizer production projects, and enhancing an Energy Department financing program. This president remains resolute and convicted to do everything we possibly can to ensure that we are doing what we can to make sure this doesn't happen again with our fertilizer prices, Rollins said. The House passed a sprawling farm bill last month that is awaiting Senate action, but it did not contain provisions aimed at reversing the price spikes. Democratic National Committee Deputy Executive Director Libby Schneider said in a statement last week that Trump's war with Iran has pushed farmers to the breaking point. Trump tanked the agricultural economy with his reckless trade war, causing family farms to go bankrupt at record levels. And now his deadly and costly war with Iran has caused prices on everything from diesel to fertilizer to skyrocket, Schneider added. Farmers are scraping by to make ends meet under Trump, and Trump and Rollins have done nothing but turn their backs on them. Democratic Senator Gary Peters of Michigan said during an April 30th Armed Services Committee meeting hearing that the number one question I get when I'm back home from people is basically very simply, when will this war end? Our farmers are paying because of fertilizer costs. We know that the whole world economy is paying a great deal for this war, Peters said. Terrence Duffy, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of financial services company CME Group, told the House Financial Services Task Force on April 29th that when you have the price of oil escalating, it's going to have an impact on some of these other derivatives of the oil product itself, including fertilizer and plastics and other components. Teen faces attempted murder charge by Jack Alkire. A 17-year-old from Bloomington has been arrested on attempted murder charges in connection with a shooting reported last weekend. According to documents released Saturday by the McLean County State's Attorney's Office, a teenage boy is charged in adult court with attempted murder and aggravated discharge of a firearm, Class X felonies, and two counts of unlawful possession of a firearm based on his age, Class 4 felonies. The prosecutor said he was arrested in connection to a shooting reported May 9th at an apartment complex near the intersection of Lincoln Street and Veterans Parkway. Bloomington police previously reported officers were dispatched about 11:15 p.m. to the 1000 block of Four Seasons Road for a report of a person struck by gunfire inside an apartment building. A man suffered a potentially life-threatening injury, police said. He was in critical condition after the shooting, but survived his injuries, according to the prosecutors. As part of their investigation, officers retrieved video surveillance of the premises and other evidence of the shooting. They also interviewed the 17-year-old, other witnesses, and the injured man, according to prosecutors. The suspect was taken into custody Friday and appeared in court on Saturday. The date of his detention hearing was not immediately available. Knight Rider car ticketed. The problem is the vehicle never left Polo Museum. By Anthony Thompson. An Illinois museum is trying to solve a real-life mystery worthy of Knight Rider after receiving a speeding ticket for a replica of Kit, the iconic talking car from the hit 1980s TV series, despite that the vehicle had never left its exhibit floor. Officials at the Volo Museum said they were stunned when a $50 traffic ticket from New York City arrived in the mail, accusing their black 1982 Pontiac Firebird Trans Am replica of speeding through Brooklyn on April 22nd. According to the citation, a traffic camera clocked the car traveling 36 miles per hour in a 25-mile-per-hour zone on Ocean Parkway at about 1:02 p.m. The summons included photos of a black Trans Am bearing the California vanity plate Knight, matching the novelty plate displayed on the museum's replica kit. There's just one problem. The museum says its car has not moved in years. The summons was mailed to the Volo Museum, where a 1982 Pontiac Firebird Trans Am replica of Kit has been on display for years as part of its Hollywood vehicle collection. The museum's marketing director, Jim Wojdilla, said it has been more than a decade since the car was last moved from its exhibit space. Museum officials said the traffic camera images from Brooklyn appear to have been incorrectly matched to the vehicle's novelty Knight plate to the Illinois display car, even though the plate is not a valid registration and the vehicle has not been driven on public roads in years. In a Facebook post, the museum said the automated system linked the California Knight plate to its exhibit car, which ultimately triggered the citation. Wojdilla said the museum received the notice on May 11th from the New York City Camera Violations Unit and initially thought it might be a joke, given its well-known collection of movie and television vehicles. "We are famous for our large movie and TV car collection, so at first we thought it was a joke," he said. "Then we looked it up on the official New York City website, and indeed it was legit." He added that the situation became even more confusing when staff examined the plate. "What's odd is that the California license plate that reads Knight isn't a registered California license plate. It's not a vanity plate at all. It's a novelty plate. We sell them in our gift shop." Wojdilla said the museum's biggest question is how a New York violation tied to a California novelty plate could be linked back to a museum in Illinois. "Our biggest confusion is how a violation in New York with a fake California plate was legally registered to a museum in Illinois. We haven't found any answers yet," he said. The museum quickly leaned into the unexpected attention online, posting about the ticket in a viral Facebook update that mixed confusion with humor. "Well, this is a new one," the post said. "A traffic camera captured Knight Rider's kit speeding down the streets of New York City." The museum added that the automated system somehow connected the novelty plate to its Illinois display vehicle. "You can't make this up," the post continued. "Our kit hasn't moved from our museum in years. Does anyone have Hasselhoff's number? He owes us $50. The museum has since requested a hearing to challenge the citation. The New York City Department of Finance and the New York City Department of Transportation and both agencies are looking into it, Wojdilla said. The USA Today has reached out to the New York City Department of Finance and the Department of Transportation for additional comment on this and clarification. And this headline, arborists alarmed by tree removals, by Noah Haggerty. The deadly fires that devastated homes in the Pacific Palisades and the Altadena also laid waste to a lush canopy of leaves and pine needles that cooled and shaded residents here for generations. Now, more than a year later, trees that survived the flames are disappearing at a troubling rate. Since the January 2025 fire siege, roughly 20% of surviving street trees have gone missing, according to preliminary results from a University of California research team. Many of the hundreds of missing trees probably would have recovered from the damage they suffered in the fires, experts say. The results from the survey of about 500 trees in the Palisades and 1,500 in Altadena, including conifers, palms, Chinese elms, and carrot woods, seem to confirm worrying patterns observed by arborists and local volunteers in the burn scars, who said losses will probably continue to come. Several factors continue to be at work. Even as the Palisades and Altadena rebuild, local governments undertook only limited efforts to water recovering trees. At the same time, building contractors were quick to remove trees that stood in the way of construction, while debris removal crews cut down living trees they mistakenly identified as dead. In response to the continuing loss of trees, a group of arborists and volunteers are working to keep recovering trees alive and hopefully someday start planting the next generation of the burn scars urban forests. While many homeowners view trees through the lens of maintenance costs, regular pruning can be expensive, and tree roots can wreak havoc on sidewalks and underground pipes. The benefits of trees are numerous and well-documented, experts say. The shade they provide and the process of evapotranspiration, where water on the surface of leaves evaporates and carries away heat, similar to how human sweat works, can cool neighborhoods by more than 10 degrees. This cooling reduces the risk of heat illness and can lower homeowner energy costs. Trees also improve air quality, improve residents' mental health, and reduce the risks of flooding and landslides. Meanwhile, fire experts say reasonably spread out and well-maintained trees do not pose a significant fire risk. Edith De Guzman, a climate change, water, and urban forestry researcher with UCLA, has been studying the burn area trees with her team. The researchers did their first assessment in the months following the fire and donned orange vests to do it again this past month. Their discovery that roughly 2 out of every 10 trees the team went back to check on were missing was particularly concerning to De Guzman because her team was looking only at public street trees, which the city and county have authority over and work to protect, as opposed to trees on private property which are maintained or felled largely at the discretion of the property owners. On private property, it's a different story, except for protected species, she said. Public trees, however, we are still seeing removals that are unnecessary, and the city is not sure who's responsible. The LA City Bureau of Street Services did not respond to a request for comment. The fires themselves killed and damaged a significant portion of the area's urban tree cover, both private and public, although precise estimates are hard to come by. Almost immediately, the surviving trees faced trouble. David Card, board president of the Palisades Forestry Committee, said shortly after the fire, trees began to fall. In the chaos of the aftermath, it was unclear what organizations or what agencies were responsible. Murdaugh saga continues. State Supreme Court overturns conviction in family murders by Jeanine Santucci. Alex Murdaugh, the former attorney who was sentenced to life in prison for the double murder of his wife and son, had those convictions overturned May 13th when the South Carolina Supreme Court said a clerk improperly influenced the trial jury. The decision does not affect a separate case in which Murdaugh confessed to and was sentenced to 40 years in federal prison for a multimillion-dollar financial fraud crime spree. Here's what to know. What was overturned? The court's decision focuses on the double murder conviction. Murdaugh's wife Maggie, 52, and son Paul, 22, were shot to death on the family's South Carolina property on June 2021, sparking an investigation that drew national attention and media coverage. The investigation also led police to reopen cases of other deaths and accusations of further crimes that went back years. Murdaugh, whose full name is Richard Alex Murdaugh, was found guilty in 2023 of the murders of his wife and son and charges for possession of a weapon. Murdaugh took the stand during his trial and denied being behind the killings, but admitted to lying about his whereabouts that day. The case was subject of a documentaries, including a popular Netflix offering in 2023. Murdaugh appealed his conviction, alleging the jury tampering and other accusations. The appeal made it to the state Supreme Court, the Greenville News reported. Why was it overturned? At the center of the ruling were the actions of a clerk who later co-authored a tell-all book, Behind the Doors of Justice, The Murdaugh Murders. Former Colleton County Clerk of Court Rebecca Hill's comments to jurors and other actions tainted the trial, his defense said. Murdaugh's attorney, Richard Harpootlian, said Hill made statements to discredit Murdaugh's trial testimony to jurors, including, don't be fooled by the defendant's arguments, don't let them confuse you and watch his actions. Prosecutors, meanwhile, disputed some of the statements and dismissed others as non-egregious, the Greenville News reported. Hill's shocking jury interference was accomplished outside the presence and knowledge of the outstanding trial judge and superbly competent and professional counsel for the state and defense, the state Supreme Court justices wrote in their 5-0 decision. Can he be retried? Murdaugh is now entitled to a new murder trial, but it will be up to the state prosecutors to decide if they will retry the case or dismiss it, the Greenville News reported. If the South Carolina Attorney General Office does not prosecute again, or does prosecute again, the state circuit court system will schedule a new trial and its venue. State Attorney General Alan Wilson said his office would seek to retry Murdaugh as soon as possible. Will he be released? Murdaugh is serving a concurrent 40-year sentence for his federal conviction on 22 charges that include bank fraud, wire fraud, and money laundering. During his federal trial, prosecutors said he stole from his legal clients and his firm. He admitted to the financial crimes, but appeared to blame them on an opiate addiction. That sentence remains unchanged. The decision also does not affect his 27-year state sentence for financial and drug crimes. What was the case about? The Murdaughs were a prominent family in South Carolina, and they ran a prosecutor's office in Hampton County for decades. Murdaugh was disbarred in 2022 after the case unraveled criminal allegations. Maggie and Paul were shot and killed at the family's estate on June 7, 2021. Investigators put the killings between 9 and 9:30 p.m. that day. Murdaugh told authorities he found them dead shortly after 10 p.m. and wasn't home when they were shot. Prosecutors said after Murdaugh was charged that he shot his family members to gain sympathy while he tried to cover up his financial crimes. While he ultimately admitted to the financial charges, he denied killing his wife and son. He suggests he believes they were killed because of a 2019 boat crash that Paul was involved in that killed a 19-year-old Mallory Beach. Court findings from a survivor of that crash alleged a possible conspiracy between the Murdaugh family and law enforcement, the Greenville News, part of the USA Today Network, reported. Police also reopened an investigation of the 2015 death of Stephen Smith, 19, in what was deemed a hit-and-run, citing evidence uncovered while investigating the Murdaugh murders. Murdaugh was shot in the head, but survived in September 2021 in what state police described as an attempted life insurance scheme, so his surviving son Buster would get his $10 million life insurance policy. He also misappropriated insurance proceeds after the 2018 death of his housekeeper, Gloria Satterfield. He eventually pled guilty to 22 state financing and drug-related charges. Strike hits UAE power plant. Efforts to end Iran war appear to have stalled by Talha Ramadan. A drone strike caused a fire at a nuclear power plant in the United Arab Emirates offices in Abu Dhabi, said Sunday, at a time when progress appears to have stalled in efforts to end the U.S.-Israeli war with Iran and restart shipping in the Gulf. Emirati officials said they were investigating the source of the strike and that the UAE had the full right to respond to such terrorist attacks. The UAE previously accused Iran of attacking its energy targets and what it has called an escalation of the conflict in the region. Also on Sunday, President Donald Trump threatened consequences for Iran if its leaders do not act quickly. For Iran, the clock is ticking and they better get moving fast or there won't be anything left of them. Time is of the essence, he wrote in a Truth Social post. The drone hit an electrical generator outside the inner perimeter of the Baqarha nuclear power plant, the Abu Dhabi media office said. Radiological safety levels were unaffected and there were no injuries, it said. The International Atomic Energy Agency said emergency diesel generators were providing power to the plant's Unit 3 and called for maximum military restraint near any nuclear power plant, and adding it was closely following this situation. The UAE Defense Ministry said two other drones were successfully dealt with and that the drones were launched from the western border. It did not elaborate. During the war that began February 28th with the U.S. and Israeli strikes against Iran, Iran has repeatedly targeted the UAE and other Gulf states that host U.S. military bases, hitting sites that include civilian and energy infrastructure. Iran stepped up such attacks on the UAE earlier this month after Trump announced a naval mission to try and open the Strait of Hormuz, which he suspended after 48 hours. More than 5 weeks after a tenuous ceasefire and the conflict took effect, the U.S. and Iranian demands remain far apart despite diplomatic efforts to end the war and reopen the strait, the world's most important shipping route for oil and gas. Washington called for Tehran to dismantle its nuclear program and lift its holds on the strait. Iran has demanded compensation for war damage, an end to U.S. lockdown of Iranian ports, and a halt to fighting on all fronts, including Lebanon, where Israel is battling Iran-backed Hezbollah. And that's the end of part one today of the Pantograph. We will be right back with part two. Stay tuned.